the time. The stock had just fallen more than 30% from its peak, but it still traded at a high multiple of its current earnings and cash flow. I made the classic mistake of thinking about the valuation in relative terms. I should simply have asked myself, is it cheap in absolute terms? Instead, I reassured myself that it was relatively cheap now that the price had dropped from its highs. I was also banking on Hughes to justify this steep valuation by delivering on his ambitious growth targets. Given his and my vision of a glorious future, I thought Smart Balance was a steal. What followed was no catastrophe, but it was hardly the triumph I had expected. When the financial crisis struck, consumers reined in their spending on higher-priced items like Smart Balance margarine. Instead of fretting about their bad cholesterol, they fretted about their finances. It didn't help that Smart Balance's rivals, stung by its success, retaliated with a price war that further eroded profits. Hughes and his team responded well in a tough environment. They kept a careful watch on pricing. Seeing the importance of offering a cheaper product, they also acquired a value brand called Best Life. Throughout this difficult period, the company generated a lot of free cash, which it deployed intelligently for marketing, debt reduction, and share repurchases. It was hard to complain, given that they did everything right. Still, by the time I finally cashed out of the stock in 2012 after 5 long years, I had lost about 30% of my money. I only had myself to blame. I had paid a high entry price that was justified only if the company lived up to its full potential. I made the mistake of basing my investment on what this superstar manager might achieve with his promising brand instead of focusing on the value of the business as it existed at the time of my purchase. Without Hughes at the helm, knowledgeable buyers from within the food industry would probably have acquired Smart Balance for 60 to 70% of the price that I had paid to invest. I should have paid even less. This would have saved me a lot of heartache. I had also overlooked the reality that all brands are not created equal. Smart Balance was a fine brand with plenty of upside, but it was no Nestlé. I've bought many cheap stocks over the years, but I'm intermittently astounded by my capacity to pay an excessive price for what I perceive to be a high-quality business. This flaw lay at the heart of my mistake in buying Smart Balance. A key lesson for me is that, in the long run, I will save an awful lot of money if I succeed in countering this tendency to overpay. This should also save a lot of my brain cells. After all, if I pay too much up front, I'd better understand everything there is to know about the company, since there is no margin of safety. If I invest when it's undervalued, I can be wrong about a whole host of issues and still make a good return. This kind of self-awareness is vital, since you can only design a checklist to address your weaknesses if you know what those weaknesses happen to be. To cite a similar example, I also overpaid for shares in Discover Financial Services, DFS, a credit card business that was spun out from Morgan Stanley in 2007. In retrospect, I can see that one idiosyncratic reason why I was drawn to DFS was that it was so intellectually difficult to analyze. It was a highly profitable company, but it's such a complex business that it was virtually impossible to know whether the moat around it would widen or narrow. My internal monologue went something like this. All these other investors think this stock is too expensive, but they're just not smart enough to appreciate the subtleties that make this such an incredible purchase. I, on the other hand, am not fearful of paying a high price because I'm smarter and can understand the nuances that they're missing. People like me, who pride ourselves on being clever and well-educated, are particularly prone to this type of narcissistic hubris. We can easily get caught up in analyzing companies that, like DFS, should really be relegated to what Buffett calls the too hard pile. Unfortunately, I wasn't sufficiently aware of these dangerous tendencies of mine back then, so I bought DFS at around $26 per share in January 2006, despite its analytical complexities. I soon came to regret it. At the height of the credit crisis, the stock fell below $5, and I couldn't be absolutely certain that the business would survive. I didn't want to compound my mistake of overpaying for it with the equally dumb mistake of selling it prematurely, so I held on. The stock rebounded sharply before I finally sold it in November 2011 for around $24, not far from my original purchase price. Still, I could have avoided all of this pain and frustration if I had been more keenly aware of those dual weaknesses of mine, my tendency to overpay and my irrational enthusiasm for analytical challenges that make me feel smart. These bruising experiences with Smart Balance and DFS led me to add some additional items to my checklist. Checklist items. Is this stock cheap enough, not just in relative terms? Am I sure that I am paying for the business as it is today, not for an excessively rosy expectation of where it might be in the future? Does this investment satisfy me psychologically by meeting some unmet personal need? For example, am I keen to buy it because it makes me feel smart? Chapter 12. Doing Business the Buffett-Pabry Way. Sitting on my shelf in Zurich is a book called The 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene. It has apparently sold more than 1.2 million copies in the United States alone and has been hailed by Fast Company as a mega cult classic. You can get a flavor of its dark message by pondering Law 14, which recommends that we should pose as a friend, work as a spy. A brief summary of this law explains, knowing about your rival is critical. Use spies to gather valuable information that will keep you a step ahead. Better still, play the spy yourself. In polite social encounters, learn to probe. Ask indirect questions to get people to reveal their weaknesses and intentions. There is no occasion that is not an opportunity for artful spying. In some ways, this scheming Machiavellian approach to life and business is quite seductive. In my youth, there was a part of me that certainly identified with it, fancying myself as a budding Gordon Gekko, with the intelligence and cunning to manipulate my way to the top. And as my experience at D.H. Blair taught me, there is plenty of opportunity on Wall Street for cynical operators to get rich by putting their own interests first. But as I later discovered, there is also a more enlightened path to success, even within the dog-eat-dog financial world, an approach that I have come to think of as the Buffett-Pabry way. By observing Warren and Monish, both from a distance and up close, I gradually learned to become a better investor, a better businessman, and, I hope, a better person. This process began when I first read Lowenstein's biography of Buffett during my time at D.H. Blair. That book changed me because it filled my head with Buffett's thoughts, introducing me to the right person and the right ideas at a critical moment when I desperately needed guidance to get out of the moral maze in which I was lost. Indeed, the best way to learn is to surround yourself with the right people. As Warren told Monish and me at our charity lunch, hang out with people better than you and you cannot help but improve. Those words have had an enormous impact on me. As Buffett helped me to understand, nothing is more important than getting better people into your life. To put it another way, relationships are the killer app. Indeed, I'm convinced that this is the single most important way that we can tilt the playing field in our favor to achieve success as investors and in other areas of life. How, then, do we create and nurture the right relationships so that we can learn from them what we need to learn and become who we ought to be? I'm not sure that I fully grasped the overwhelming importance of our peer group until I came across a fascinating book and a subsequent TED Talk by Nicholas Christakis. He and his colleagues at Harvard had studied obesity in human networks, and this research led them to an important discovery. If you have obese friends, you're more likely to be obese. Similarly, if you have fit and healthy friends, you're more likely to be fit and healthy. In other words, our close social connections count not only in the obvious ways, but also in subtle ways that we barely understand. I have no doubt that this is also the case in business. If so, it stands to reason that I should make a conscious effort to have the best possible people in my social networks. At first, I approached this idea in a calculated and self-serving manner, hoping that my attempts to build social capital would lead me to greater financial and professional success. But the relationships that I began to form were so life-enriching that my cynical motives gradually receded. I'm not saying that I'm Mahatma Gandhi, but my deepening bonds with great people became a source of such sincere joy to me that I no longer needed any hidden agenda. These friendships became a wonderful end in themselves, not a means to self-advancement. Serendipitously, I'm writing these words in the Delamar Greenwich Harbour Hotel in Connecticut, the very place where I had my first dinner with Monish a decade ago, on February the 11th, 2004. That meeting led to a friendship that has been one of the greatest pleasures of my life, a relationship that really illustrates everything I hope to convey in this chapter. Just yesterday, I received an email from Monish with the subject line, "Need to put the book on hold. The next idea is upon us." His five-word email message then named an Asian company along with the phrase, a 4X. In other words, he'd found a stock that he thought could go up fourfold, and he wanted me to know about it too. At the same time, he trusted me to look into it further and give him a useful second opinion, just as Buffett has for decades turned to Charlie Munger, though admittedly the quality of the response might be a tad higher in Charlie's case. Think about this. Here is Monish, one of the great investors of our time, happily sharing his latest investment idea with me. At one level, this act of kindness could be a tremendous financial gift for me and my shareholders if my research leads me to the same conclusion and I buy the stock. But at a deeper level, that simple email is a gift of true friendship, an act of sharing, trust, generosity, and affection. This act is also built on an understanding of the unsurpassed power of friendship, a recognition that when we join together with good intentions, we are much more than the sum of our parts. As Monish often says, quoting an old adage that Ronald Reagan loved, "There's no limit to what you can do if you don't mind who gets the credit." What more could I ask for than a friend like this? I hope that I'm making this sufficiently clear, because it's almost certainly the most important point in this book, even though it may seem blindingly obvious to you. Nothing, nothing at all, matters as much as bringing the right people into your life. They will teach you everything you need to know. In countless ways, this relationship with Monish has been an eye-opening education for me. For example, over the past 10 years, I've repeatedly observed how he looks to see what he can do for others, not the other way around. He never sat me down and explained the thinking behind this behavior. I simply witnessed how he acted with me and with others, and I tried my best to learn from it. I saw how he would focus first on creating a real relationship and would then constantly look for ways to give, not take. He wasn't pushy. He didn't put people under any obligation. He seemed simply to ask himself, "What can I do for them?" Sometimes this was a kind word or a piece of advice. Sometimes it was an introduction to someone else. Sometimes it was a book that he would send as a gift, as a way of saying that he was thinking of that person. By acting in this way, I could see that Monish created an incredible network of people who wish him well and would love to find ways to help him and thank him for his kindness. This is the extraordinarily powerful effect of compounding goodwill by being a giver, not a taker. And as he has taught me, the paradox is that you end up receiving infinitely more in life by giving than by taking. There's a real irony here. In focusing on helping others, you end up helping yourself too. For some people, this is not easy to understand. They act instead as if life were a zero-sum game, in which the person who gives something away is the poorer for it. Buffett, of course, understands this perfectly, thanks in no small part to the influence and example of his late wife, Susan, who is the kindest and most giving of people. After visiting her in hospital, he told a class at Georgia Tech, "When you get to my age, you'll really measure your success in life by how many of the people you want to have love you actually love you. I know people who have a lot of money, and they get testimonial dinners and they get hospital wings named after them, but the truth is that nobody in the world loves them. If you get to my age in life and nobody thinks well of you, I don't care how big your bank account is, your life is a disaster. That's the ultimate test of how you have lived your life." He continued, "The trouble with love is that you can't buy it. You can buy sex, you can buy testimonial dinners, you can buy pamphlets that say how wonderful you are, but the only way to get love is to be lovable. It's very irritating if you have a lot of money. You'd like to think you could write a check, 'I'll buy $1 million worth of love,' but it doesn't work that way. The more you give love away, the more you get. Of all the lessons that Warren has taught me, perhaps this is the most important." Anybody who sees Buffett merely as a great stock picker is clearly missing the point. At our charity lunch, his kindness and generosity of spirit were unmistakable. He was evidently determined to deliver much more value to us than we could possibly have hoped for or expected. He was there to give, both to the Glyde Foundation and to us, not to receive. He wasn't just polite and cordial. He was there with every ounce of his being, trying to make this an occasion that we would never forget. Here was one of the richest men in the world, a man who could gain nothing from us, yet he took the care to treat us in this way. I also saw this in the years that followed, when he made the effort to give Monish and me a tour of his office, or to send me a note that said something like, "Enjoyed reading your annual report, Guy." This message, scrawled in a few seconds, was a small act of kindness that, coming from him, meant the world to me. If there's a reward for acting this way, I would suggest that it's simply the happiness and lightness of heart that he derives from this approach to life. I don't believe that he behaves this way with any agenda, but Warren, like Monish, innately understands that this is the way the universe works. The more we give, the more we receive. Warren's life is one of the great examples of this benevolent cycle. But perhaps the most important point to make here is that this is how we learn. By watching people who are better than us, modeling their behavior, then experiencing for ourselves why their approach is wise and works. The point is not to lionize Warren or Monish, who have flaws and foibles just like the rest of us. It's to share this idea that there is no more important aspect of our education as investors, business people, and human beings than to find these exceptional role models who can guide us on our own journey. Books are a priceless source of wisdom, but people are the ultimate teachers, and there may be lessons that we can only learn from observing them or being in their presence. In many cases, these lessons are never communicated verbally, yet you feel the guiding spirit of that person when you're with them. One of my favorite examples of this is from Li Lu's introduction to the Chinese edition of Poor Charlie's Almanac. He tells a wonderful anecdote about Charlie Munger, in which, no matter how early he showed up for an appointment, Munger was always there before him. Each time, Li Lu would show up earlier and earlier, and each time, Munger was already there. Eventually, Li Lu was showing up as much as 1 hour early, so they would each read their newspapers separately until the meeting began at the appointed time. Apparently, Charlie had once been late for an important meeting through no fault of his own, and he had vowed to himself never to let it happen again. As for Warren, he's a social animal and has built an ecosystem around himself of remarkable people who reflect and reinforce his own values. His inner circle includes Charlie Munger, Bill Gates, Ajit Jain, Debbie Bosanek, and Carol Loomis, but there are many others too. These people look out for him, and he looks out for them. Again and again, he has proved to be an astute judge of character, allying himself with outstanding people and making amazingly few mistakes. At times, I suspect that he bought certain companies not just because these were great businesses, but because they were run by great people whom he wanted in this ecosystem. People like Thomas Murphy, who headed Capital Cities ABC, and Rose Blumkin. He loved to tell stories about Blumkin's astonishing work ethic, and he clearly saw her as a role model. In my own experience, there are countless ways of improving the circles in which we operate. Some of these are so obvious that it's tempting not to mention them at all, but these simple, practical steps have made such a difference to my life that I'll briskly mention some of them, even at the risk of sounding trite. For example, I joined various organizations where I could regularly rub shoulders with people who were better than me in a multitude of ways. This includes two extraordinary business groups that teach leadership qualities, the Entrepreneurs Organization and the Young Presidents Organization. I also joined Toastmasters, which teaches leadership through public speaking. Likewise, I met with a wonderful assortment of value investors once a month at Manhattan's Kolbe Restaurant as part of a group organized by Shaidar Dashti. Some of my most valuable business relationships grew out of these monthly lunches. Having seen how much it helps to be part of a group like this, I later teamed up with John Mihaljevic to create ValueX as a place where like-minded people can develop their worldly wisdom, learn to be better investors, and become better people in the process. The goal is to build a community in which we can all have a positive influence on one another. After all, it's so much easier to stay on track when you have support instead of going it alone. For similar reasons, my family became members of the local Jewish community in Zurich. As Christakis had shown me, our peer group has a far-reaching influence on us, so I figured that being a member of a religious community would increase the odds that we would elevate ourselves spiritually and morally as a family, much as I figured that attending the annual meetings of Berkshire in Omaha and Wesco in Pasadena would elevate me as an investor. Initially, I had thought that participating in groups and events like these would allow me to meet better people and that these contacts would help me to advance myself. Certainly, there are benefits to that kind of networking, but for me, the greatest benefit to hanging out in these positive environments was a more subtle one, the opportunity to observe people who were far better at business and life than I was. This is one of the many reasons why attending Berkshire's annual meeting is such a rich learning experience. For example, one year I was having a drink in Omaha with a friend named Jonathan Brandt when I noticed that Don Keough was standing nearby. Keough is a renowned business leader who has served on the boards of companies like Berkshire, Coca-Cola, and McDonald's. He recognized Jonathan, whose father had been Buffett's stockbroker, exchanged some thoughts with him, then took the trouble to introduce himself to me. I had an electric feeling, as if all his energies were focused on me. For that instant, I felt like I was the only person who mattered to him. Of course, you could say that this was simply the polite and decent behavior that we should expect from anyone, which is true. But even a fleeting encounter like this helped me to discern some of the qualities that allow people to shine in business. For example, I could see from Keough's impact on me just how important it is to be fully present and engaged whenever I meet someone, particularly if that person is at an earlier stage in their career or if they might be ill at ease. His example made me aspire to be better so that my own meetings with strangers might one day be similarly memorable and genuine. Likewise, I'm struck by how often and enthusiastically Buffett speaks to MBA students. It's a time in their lives when they are particularly open to new ideas, and if they haven't yet secured a post-MBA job, they might also feel a little vulnerable. So his generous spirit may mean all the more to them. There's a great lesson in this for me. If Warren can take the time to act like this with students, not to mention with investors like me, then I too need to act with real kindness toward the students I meet at business schools, and I should also respond encouragingly to every young graduate who sends me a resume. At our lunch, Monish asked Warren how he's managed to select the right people with whom to associate. Warren replied that he can survey a room filled with 100 people and easily identify the 10 he'd do business with and the 10 he'd avoid. The other 80 would go into his not sure category. At the time, I didn't find this insight particularly satisfying, but I later realized that I should have applied this thinking before going to work for D.H. Blair. There had been enough smoke to raise real concerns about the existence of fire, including the critical article I had read about the firm in the New York Times. On that basis alone, the company and its charismatic leader, Morty Davis, should have gone into my own not sure category. Temperamentally, I like to be fair and to give people the benefit of the doubt, but in this instance, circumspection would have served me better. In any case, the key lesson from Warren was to invest time and energy in the handful of people you're sure about and leave the rest alone. On this basis, I decided that I needed to become more efficient at eliminating people from my network if I wasn't sure about them. The first place where I applied this idea was in my hiring process. I had originally assumed that the right way to hire is to place an advertisement and then sift through the many resumes that came my way, trying to give every candidate the benefit of the doubt. After all, this is how consulting firms and investment banks did it when they went about hiring people like me. But one well-documented problem with this approach is that a high proportion of these job candidates have some attribute that makes them hard to employ, while the best candidates get snapped up fast. Those who don't get snapped up fast also tend to get better at disguising their flaws, which become harder and harder to discern. So I stopped advertising. Instead, I ended up hiring people whose behavior I had a chance to observe in unguarded moments. For example, I hired Dan Moore as an analyst after contacting him about a piece of equity research he had done. He wouldn't share it with me because I wasn't a client of his buy-side firm. The exemplary way that he handled this situation showed me the high quality of his ethics and his loyalty to his employer. This insight into his character was a key reason for my offering him a job. Likewise, I hired Ollie Hindi, my director of operations, after meeting her at a Kolbe dinner, where I saw how gracefully she handled a difficult social encounter. This provided me with a perfect example of her remarkable people skills. Indeed, my most successful hires have happened not because I advertised the position, but because I observed the person in candid moments like these, when they were simply being themselves. At the same time, I also consciously moved away from dealing with anyone who struck me as mysterious or opaque in any way. In my impressionable youth, I had a number of glittering, socially prominent friends who were obscure about who they really were. After leaving Oxford, I was naively dazzled by someone who claimed to be a Tartar prince. That summer, we gallivanted around London and the French Riviera, meeting other supposed princes and princesses. I found it exciting, and I enjoyed the feeling that I was entering these rarefied social circles. In a way, it was just a bit of frivolous fun, but it was also mildly pernicious to be captivated by this world of superficial glamour. Monish showed me a better way. In his view, life is just too short to deal with people who aren't straightforward and forthcoming about who they are. The best strategy is simply to leave the mysterious obfuscators alone. The goal is not to figure them out, but to keep a distance. Warren and Monish, who are both down-to-earth and entirely lacking in pretense, are only interested in dealing with people who are an open book. They distance themselves from all the others, leaving them in the not-sure category, which is the human equivalent of the too-hard box on Warren's desk. Before I have an appointment with a person I don't already know, I typically provide them with written information about myself. For example, my bio and my fund's annual report. I want to make it as easy as possible for them to see where I'm coming from and to form an accurate impression of me. Likewise, I routinely ask them to send me some background material about themselves. If people are enigmatic or elusive in any way, I apply Buffett's not sure rule and decide against a closer relationship. By the same token, I hope they will see that I really am who I appear to be, not a fake who deceives either himself or others. I want to be the same person on the inside as on the outside. In business, as in other areas of life, I would argue that we attract people who are similar to us, who reflect the level of our own consciousness. If I strive to be honest and decent, I'm more likely to bring into my life people who are honest and decent. This helps to explain why Buffett has drawn such remarkable people into his orbit. They provide a reflection of who he is. By observing Monish, I also learned another key lesson about how to behave, both in business and in other areas of life. I could see that he was never needy or demanding in the way that he dealt with people. There was no sense of entitlement or desire to encroach on their time. In the early days of our relationship, I'd call him in California and say apologetically, "I hope you're not busy and that I'm not disturbing you." He'd reply, "Busy? On the contrary, I was just twiddling my thumbs." It wasn't true, but it was his way of making me feel that nothing was more important than my call. Indeed, on countless occasions, I've received emails in which he says, "Call if you're twiddling." Similarly, when we travelled to Omaha to meet Debbie Bosanek for lunch in 2010, he wrote to her, "Our schedule is very flexible. Feel free to suggest whatever is ideal for you." This isn't a question of being sycophantic or losing his own sense of self. On the contrary, Monish has a healthy ego. But I've repeatedly seen how careful he is not to impose himself on others or to ride roughshod over their interests. He wants to show up only where he's needed or wanted. He takes great care not to be a burden to anyone or to make them feel like they have any obligation to him. Watching him act like this had a profound impact on me because I could see so clearly that it was a great way to behave. I remember discussing with him a situation in which an investor wanted to sell his stake in my fund. My father initially suggested that I try to dissuade the person, but Monish told me, "Don't try to convince them. It's their money. If they want to take it out, let them do it. No questions asked." The relationship with my investor might have been ending, but Monish helped me to see that there should be no guilt or recrimination, and above all, no sense of obligation. This simple but robust idea has radiated out into many other areas of my life. To give you just one example, I never tried to solicit my friends, or anyone else for that matter, to invest in my fund. I'm happy for them just to be my friends. There is never any obligation. Yet looking back, I can see how appallingly needy I was in my early years as a fund manager. Back then, I had somehow convinced myself that it was important to sell myself and my fund to prospective investors, as if this brazen pushiness were an integral part of being a smart businessman and a high-flying fund manager. In reality, this was just an embarrassing example of my neediness. I also came to see what a turn-off it had been when I cold-called someone in an attempt to drum up business, or when I sent out a mass email in the vain hope of seizing the attention of prospective investors who had expressed no interest at all in the fund. This can only have made it less likely that discerning people would want to establish closer ties with me. By contrast, I love the story of Ian Jacobs, a Columbia Business School graduate who successfully applied for a job with Buffett at Berkshire's headquarters. Along with his cover letter, Jacobs apparently enclosed a check to recompense Warren for his time in evaluating this job application. Some people saw this as a ridiculous gimmick, but the check, which I'm sure was never cashed, would have instantly communicated the message that Jacobs respected the value of Buffett's time. It was a powerful signal that he did not want to be a burden. This is a smart way to act, not least because people get defensive when they sense that we want something from them or harbor a hidden agenda. I began to realize that my attempts to grab attention or impose myself on others were particularly annoying when I was dealing with important people, since they are so often targeted in this way. Not long ago, I had an unforgettable lunch with the CEO of a major bank. Early in our meeting, I told him sincerely that I just felt so blessed in my life and so fortunate to be there with him. He relaxed visibly when he realized that I wasn't angling for anything, but just wanted to enjoy his company. The key, in my experience, is to value people as an end in themselves, not as a means to our own ends. Monish often quotes a beautiful line from the Bible, "I am but dust and ashes." Now, like me, he is a work in progress, and there's a hint of irony in his voice when he says this, as if to acknowledge that he has not quite reached this level of humility and self-abnegation. Neither of us could lay convincing claims to sainthood quite yet. Still, I've repeatedly seen his desire to serve others and not to put his needs above theirs. His example has helped me to understand that it's possible to be a servant without losing your autonomy, self-respect, or ambition. In my early years as a fund manager, I would have mocked the idea of being a servant. I preferred to see myself as a smart manipulator. But at our charity lunch, Warren was also a servant of sorts, despite being the world's most famous investor. Thanks in large part to Monish and Warren, I began to realize that I ought to focus more on what others need from me instead of constantly trying to get them to fulfill my own needs. This might sound obvious, but it's been a huge psychological shift for me, and it's really changed the way that I live my life. In my New York vortex days, I would go to a networking event, meet a stranger, and wonder how they could help me. Often they'd talk at me about whatever product or service they wanted to sell, and I started to see how repulsive this sort of agenda-driven approach to business can be. So over time, I developed a different attitude to networking. My simple rule was that, whenever I met someone, I would try to do something for them. It might simply be an introduction to someone else, or even just a sincere compliment. What was intriguing to me was the way they reacted. In some cases, I sensed that they were saying to themselves, "That's nice. I wonder what else this guy is going to do for me, or what else I can ask him for." In other cases, I could see that they wanted to help me too. These seemingly trivial interactions provided a barometer of whether people approach the world as givers or takers. At first, I attracted a high proportion of takers. For a while, I found myself getting ridiculously upset about it, wondering why they didn't understand that this was a lousy way to live. But by observing people closely, I gradually became a better judge of who was a giver and who was a taker, and I began to attract better people into my life. I hope this doesn't sound more calculated than it is, because what I'm trying to do is simply create an ecosystem for myself in which everybody is the type of person who wants to find ways of helping others. When you're surrounded by people like this, all of them trying to help one another, it sometimes feels like heaven on earth. People like Monish or John Mihaljevic, for example, are just gems, always looking to help, to support, to share. These are the keepers, the people we want in our inner circle, the people we should fly across the world to see if they live abroad. And of course, this is what I need to be for others. The crazy thing is that when you start to live this way, everything becomes so much more joyful. There is a sense of flow and alignment with the universe that I never felt when everything was about what I could take for myself. Again, I don't want to make this sound like I'm some kind of saint, but this experience of finding ways to serve others has been so overwhelmingly positive that I now find myself looking for more and more opportunities to help. These days, my focus isn't just on helping individuals, but also organizations, such as my Oxford College, Harvard Business School, and the Weizmann Institute. I recently realized that the Entrepreneurs Organization doesn't have a chapter in Israel, so I set one up. I also learned that there was no TEDx event in Zurich, so I co-founded one. I'm not telling you this to be self-congratulatory, as there are countless people who do so much more good than I do. The point is simply that my life has improved immeasurably since I began to live this way. In truth, I've become increasingly addicted to the positive emotions awakened in me by these activities. I also love the deepening sense of connection that I've gained to so many great people and institutions. One thing is for sure, I receive way more by giving than I ever did by taking. So, paradoxically, my attempts at selflessness may actually be pretty selfish. Warren and Monish, who are two of the smartest guys on earth, clearly understand this. As an investor and a businessman, Warren's achievements are almost inconceivable, yet his greatest legacy may well be his philanthropic work in supporting the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which could affect millions of people. Likewise, Monish hasn't devoted his considerable gifts to the single-minded pursuit of wealth. His Dakshana Foundation is already transforming the lives of countless young Indians, giving them opportunities that might otherwise be unthinkable. He has told me more than once that he would prefer to be remembered for Dakshana than as an investor. The goal for the rest of us is not to be Warren Buffett or Monish Pabrai, but to learn from them. In big ways and small, I've come to see them both as grandmasters in the game of life. To repeat that all-important line from Warren, hang out with people better than you, and you cannot help but improve. Chapter 13. The Quest for True Value. If your goal in life is to get rich, value investing is pretty hard to beat. Sure, there are times when it falls out of favor, when even the greatest practitioners find themselves dismissed as fusty has-beens who have lost their touch. But it's such a robust and fundamentally sound way to invest that it eventually regains its luster. Irrational exuberance comes and goes. The quest for value endures. Still, this is not just a stock-picking strategy that can make you rich. To me, even the phrase itself, value investing, implies something deeper than merely accumulating the millions required to buy a mansion in Greenwich, a ski chalet in Gstaad, and a gleaming Ferrari. As Warren Buffett's life exemplifies, what we are also talking about here is a quest for true value, for some kind of meaning that goes beyond money, professional advancement, or social cachet. I don't mean to dismiss or deride those things. While I'm slightly sheepish about my baser, more capitalist instincts, I'm not that sheepish. I do still drive a convertible Porsche, even though I'm mildly embarrassed to admit it. And I'm so obsessed with my pursuit of the perfect cappuccino that I spent $6,000 on an exquisite La Marzocco coffee machine, which I imported from Florence. I try to justify these excesses by contemplating the image of Sir John Templeton, who gave a fortune to charity, driving a Rolls-Royce. Of course, even Buffett bought a private jet, which he self-mockingly named the Indefensible. Later, having changed his mind, he rechristened it the Indispensable. And for that matter, Charlie Munger spent millions on a luxury catamaran called the Channel Cat. If stuff like this turns you on, then value investing is a great means to your self-indulgent ends. Enjoy. As I see it, this is the outer journey of the value investor. The quest for wealth, physical comfort, and, for want of a better word, success. But it's important not to get so caught up in this meaningless chase that we forget what matters most, the inner journey towards something less tangible yet more valuable. The inner journey is the path to becoming the best version of ourselves that we can be, and this strikes me as the only true path in life. It involves asking questions such as, what is my wealth for? What gives my life meaning? And how can I use my gifts to help others? Relatively early in his investing career, Buffett closed down his limited partnerships and returned the assets to his shareholders. Even then, he just wasn't that interested in the unbridled pursuit of wealth. Clearly, it's not money that makes him tap dance to work. Likewise, Munger has said that once you've made a certain amount, I think it was $100 million, there would have to be something wrong in your head for you to continue dedicating yourself to the accumulation of wealth. Templeton also devoted much of his life to the inner journey. Indeed, his greatest legacy is his charitable foundation, which explores the big questions of human purpose and ultimate reality, including complexity, evolution, infinity, creativity, forgiveness, love, gratitude, and free will. The foundation's motto is, "How little we know, how eager to learn." In my experience, the inner journey is not only more fulfilling, but is also a key to becoming a better investor. If I don't understand my inner landscape, including my fears, insecurities, desires, biases, and attitude to money, I'm likely to be mugged by reality. This happened early in my career, when my greed and arrogance led me to D.H. Blair. My desperate need to appear successful then made it difficult to admit my mistake and leave the company quickly after concluding that it was a morally corrosive environment. Later, in my New York vortex years, my envy of people with bigger funds and more glamorous homes led me astray again, convincing me that I needed to market myself and try to become something that wasn't true to who I am. By embarking on the inner journey, I became more self-aware and began to see these flaws more clearly. I could work to overcome them only once I acknowledged them. But these traits were so deep-seated that I also had to find practical ways to navigate around them. For example, by moving to Zurich, I physically removed myself from an environment in Manhattan that exacerbated my greed and envy. Knowing that cities like New York and London, the epicenters of extremistan, had this destabilizing effect on me, it seemed safest to get away. But this is an ongoing process. As I write, my wife is exploring the possibility of moving our family to London so that we can be closer to my parents, my sister, and our children's cousins. In some ways, this scares me. Will I be able to deal with the emotional turmoil that London, with its extremes of wealth, might stir in me? Have I grown enough internally that I can move there without being emotionally destabilized? Can I create a peaceful environment for myself, even within London? For example, in a quiet suburb, far from the reality distortion of the super prime areas, where my mind can remain a calm pond. At the moment, the answers are unclear, but this is all part of my inner journey, as I grapple with the idiosyncrasies that make it hard for me to be a rational investor. Ignorance is not bliss when it comes to investing, because the financial markets are mercilessly effective at exposing these emotional weaknesses. During the credit crisis, for example, it was vital to understand my own complex attitude to money, since this affected my judgment and my ability to deal with the psychological impact of the crashing stock market. Intellectually, it's easy enough to master the technical tools of investing, the ability to read balance sheets, say, and to identify undervalued companies. But what good are these skills to investors who are drowning in a sea of fear that utterly overwhelms their rational neocortex? Taking personal responsibility rather than blaming others is crucial. Instead of criticizing the fickle shareholders who bailed out of my fund at the bottom of the market, it was much more useful for me to think carefully about what it would mean to me if the market continued to crash and I had to close my fund. Why would it be so unbearably painful? For me, this inner aspect of the market meltdown was very different than it was for Monish, who seemed entirely unaffected by the plunging prices of the stocks in his portfolio. As Monish tells it, he spent an important part of his youth witnessing the many ups and downs of his father's business career. Apparently, there were multiple occasions when his father was on the brink of financial collapse or actually went broke. Yet even amid that tumult, his family interactions were remarkably serene. So for Monish, the prospect of financial disaster is not as emotionally fraught as it might be for me. One happy result of his emotional fortitude was that he was able to keep buying busted stocks at a point where other investors might have been more inclined to curl up in a fetal position in a quiet corner of the office. My own attitude to money is deeply influenced by the painful history of European Jewry. My great-grandparents were wealthy German industrialists who owned a major hat factory outside Berlin. Then the Nazis seized their assets and destroyed their life of privilege. My family escaped to Israel, then Palestine, where they set about reconstructing what they had lost. My grandfather, who had been a lawyer in Germany, became an unsuccessful Israeli chicken farmer. I grew up hearing tales of food shortages and of young men going off to defend the country during those early years in Israel. My father, having grown up on his parents' chicken farm, spent much of his career as a corporate salaryman. He then started a business that generated excess cash, which I invested for him. By now, I've multiplied our family's wealth fivefold, but I still have a deep-seated fear that factors beyond my control could sweep everything away. Why does any of this matter? Because this narrative subtly but powerfully shapes my entire approach to business and investing. For example, I never use borrowed money, and all my investments are sober and conservative. For me, the story of my family and money has been one of restoration, of fixing the damage that Hitler wrought. I feel a tremendous sense of responsibility when it comes to my family's finances, most of which are invested in my fund, not least because I'm attempting to repair what was shattered more than 70 years ago, and to provide enduring security in an insecure world. I love what I do, but this is a serious business for me. And we know that money is closely associated with survival in the human mind, so these emotional issues have the potential to torpedo my rational brain. By contrast, Monish can buy stocks with a higher level of uncertainty and volatility, since for him, the possibility of loss doesn't trigger the kind of fears that are hardwired into my system. I would argue that serious investors need to understand the complexities of their relationship to money, given its capacity to wreak havoc. Based on that understanding, we can make adjustments, for example, changing our physical environment or adding certain items to our investment checklist. But I'm not convinced that it's entirely possible to change the wiring itself, however smart we might be. I certainly haven't managed it yet. I used to think that I could overcome my fear of financial loss, thereby freeing myself to take more risk and achieve higher returns, but I've gradually come to accept that this is just part of who I am. There's no doubt that Warren and Monish have inner landscapes that better equip them to make clear-headed decisions involving money. But I can't spend my life yearning to be them. Instead, I need to understand what makes me different, then make investments that I can handle emotionally, based on this self-knowledge. In the end, I handled the financial crisis well, partly because I confronted my fears of loss and found ways to work around them. If I hadn't been aware of this aspect of my inner life, I might have panicked when a stock like Discover Financial Services fell 80%. Instead, I held steady as it rebounded. Having gained a deeper sense of who I am, I've also stopped worrying about trying to get the best returns. I'm more comfortable aiming for decent returns that beat the market indexes over the long term, despite my personal limitations. Similarly, I've always invested a hefty portion of my fund in Berkshire Hathaway. Given the company's enormous size, I could probably get better returns by investing elsewhere, but Berkshire's presence in my portfolio provides a ballast, both financially and emotionally. It's psychologically important to have Buffett in my ecosystem. Is this rational? For me, yes. For Monish, maybe not. Given the importance of this inner journey, how, in practical terms, should we go about it? Personally, I've used countless tools to accelerate this process of inward growth, and I found them all helpful or interesting at different stages in my life. I've done lots of psychotherapy, even though this would have appalled me in my closed-minded youth. Among other things, I did 7 years of Jungian therapy once a week, and I've dabbled in things like emotionally focused therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, neuro-linguistic programming, and even eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. As I came to realize, humans are infinite in their variety, and there is an almost infinite variety of therapies to help us undertake this journey. I've also delved into religion with various rabbis and other spiritual teachers, including my friend Isaac Sassoon, who is the author of a book called Destination Torah, Reflections on the Weekly Torah Readings. I've had regular sessions with career coaches. I've studied philosophy and became friends with Lou Marinoff, a philosophical counselor, who is the author of Plato, Not Prozac, Applying Eternal Wisdom to Everyday Problems. And I've read countless self-help books. Temperamentally, I'm not well suited to meditation, but I'm open to pretty much anything as long as I might learn something. Another fantastic tool for internal growth is the experience of adversity. Indeed, this should really be the first tool of all. If we take responsibility for our mistakes and failures, they offer priceless opportunities to learn about ourselves and how we need to improve. My mistake in joining D.H. Blair, for example, enabled me to see that I had to deal with my avarice and also stop measuring myself by an outer scorecard. Adversity may, in fact, be the best teacher of all. The only trouble is that it takes a long time to live through our mistakes and then learn from them, and it's a painful process. For me, the greatest springboard for the inner journey has been to participate in what Napoleon Hill would call a mastermind group. Harvard Business School calls it a study group, and the Young President's Organization calls it Forum. The name doesn't matter. The idea is for a close-knit group of about 8 to 10 professionals to share their issues confidentially, guided by a peer moderator. On one memorable occasion, I gave a 20-minute presentation about my tortured relationship with a key business associate who was also a close friend from university. The group then subjected me to 2 rounds of clarifying questions, which left all the details of the relationship out in the open for them to examine. My chest burned with anger. I was convinced that my friend had done things that were wrong and unfair, and that she was taking advantage of me. But I also felt guilty and embarrassed, since it became increasingly clear during this session that I hadn't behaved that well either. Then, one by one, the other 8 members of the group shared their own experiences of business relationships with friends or relatives that had gone awry. My first reaction was intense relief as I realized that I wasn't alone in making such mistakes. I also came to see that neither my friend nor I had acted quite as badly as I had believed. Equally important, nobody passed judgment on me, and I received no explicit advice, since this would have violated the group's rules. Still, by the end of the discussion, I no longer felt that my guilt and anger were controlling me, and the 8 stories were replete with examples of the type of actions that I could take to fix the situation. Instead of feeling powerless, I now had lots of options. As a result, I resolved my conflict in a positive way, and my former business associate remains a dear friend and a shareholder in my fund to this day. Such is the power of a mastermind group. Whether it's arranged by the Young President's Organization, or the Entrepreneurs Organization, or a handful of trusted friends like the members of the Latticework Club, which Monish and I created. Twice a year, this group of 8 professionals heads off for a 3-day retreat to discuss whatever is on our minds. For me, meetings like these have been the single best accelerator of inner growth. The truth is that it doesn't matter how you do this inner journey. What matters is that you do it. Whichever route you choose, the goal is to become more self-aware, strip away your facades, and listen to the interior. For an investor, the benefits are immeasurable, because this self-knowledge helps us to become stronger internally and to be better equipped to deal with adversity when it inevitably comes. The stock market has an uncanny way of finding us out, of exposing weaknesses as diverse as arrogance, jealousy, fear, anger, self-doubt, greed, dishonesty, and the need for social approval. To achieve sustainable success, we need to confront our vulnerabilities, whatever they may be. Otherwise, we are building our success on a fragile structure that is ultimately liable to fall down. But the real reward of this inner transformation is not just enduring investment success, it's the gift of becoming the best person we can be. That, surely, is the ultimate prize. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Education of a Value Investor, My Transformative Quest for Wealth, Wisdom and Enlightenment, written by Guy Speer, narrated by Malk Williams, producer Mike Charzuk, copyright 2014 by Guy Speer, production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.